Oh, good evening. And I want to begin by thanking the museum and Carol Steele in particular for the invitation to speak to you here tonight. The last time that I was here was also the first time. It was back in the summer of 1986, just after the museum had opened. And it was a very special experience to come and see Freud's couch and his garden. His relocation here meant that his genius loci was now to reside in both Vienna and London. I later had the good fortune to meet and interview Edmund Engelmann, the photographer who left us his unique record of Freud's home at Berggasse 19. He took the pictures during the emotionally charged days just prior to the family's departure in 1938. He reminisced about later visiting the apartment when it was being renovated as a museum. It was empty and rather shabby, but when he walked into the former consulting room, he said that he could see what he called the ghost of the couch on the exposed wooden floor. This image can serve as a symbolic portal to so much of what was to define 20th century culture and therapy. It reminds us once again that the past never entirely disappears. A series of centennials are now underway, marking the cavalcade of carnage that characterized the past century. Another anniversary, one with its own special animosities, legends, and legacy, albeit in a very different key, is that marking the final split between Freud and Jung. The title of my paper, Carl Gustav Jung, Avant-Garde Conservative, Texts and Contexts, lets you know from which side of that divide I have approached their relationship. The men are modern totem figures, secular saints whose lightning rod relationship exhibited a strong attraction, but an equally strong aversion. The Oedipal lens through which their dyad has been viewed needs to be considered within its broader cultural context. But first, what constellated their relationship in the first place? One major factor was their shared Central European humanistic education with its passion for classical antiquity. The field's increasingly narrow philological approach was in the process of being upended by books like Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy and the archaeological discoveries of Heinrich Schliemann at Troy and Mycenae. So just a visual, the strata of the Trojan cities. Besides being the century of science, the 19th century was also the century of history. Freud's collection of antiquities and Jung's boyhood ambition to become an archaeologist remind us that archaeology was the key cultural metaphor in the formative years of psychoanalysis. The various strata of the psyche needed careful excavating in order to bring their artifacts to light. Their collaboration initiated a major paradigm shift in the modern understanding of myth. Previously, mythology had been just a minor prerequisite for tourists visiting the museums and ancient ruins of Italy. Later in the century, Fraser, in his Golden Bough, made the convincing case that myth was in fact a contemporary reality, but only as a vestige of a primitive mode of thinking still to be found among the peasant classes of Europe and the natives of the overseas colonies. With their identification of the Oedipus and Electra complexes, Freud and Jung discovered that myth was a living system to be found deep in the psyches of every modern man and woman. To recap this movement from the 19th to the 20th centuries, we notice that the locus of myth shifts from back then to down or over there to in here. Jung's famous dream of a house with different historical levels marked a milestone in his growing divergence from Freud, whom he felt was interpreting libido in terms that were too narrowly personalistic. Jung was beginning to speak of what he called parental imagos that reflected a collective cultural dimension of the psyche that he first called the Urbilder, or primordial images, a Goethean term that he borrowed from Jacob Burckhardt, the cultural historian whose work was a major intellectual influence in Jung's hometown of Basel. Freud and Jung can then be seen as spokesmen for alternate hermeneutical systems for interpreting the role of the past in the human experience. That the two men went in different directions was in great part due to the generational divide that had taken place in German classical scholarship. Before proceeding, I want to acknowledge the two books that most helped me understand this development: Suzanne Marchand's Down from Olympus and George Williamson's The Longing for Myth in Germany. Freud belonged to a mid-century generation of neo-humanist liberals who had made Periclean Athens their spiritual template by enshrining Socrates and Sophoclean tragedy as their supreme intellectual ideals. Jung, on the other hand, belonged to the generation of the 1890s who favored Euripides, pre-Socratic philosophers like Heraclitus, and the cosmopolitan syncretism of Hellenistic Alexandria. Arthur Evans had unearthed the Minoan civilization on Crete and revolutionized the study of the history of religions. Mystery religions like Mithraism and gods like Abraxas were in vogue, and Jung was deeply interested in both of them. He imagined psychoanalysis as a modern initiation ritual, a sentiment most vividly captured in a letter that he wrote to Freud. Quote, "We must give psychoanalysis time to infiltrate into people from many centers. To revivify among intellectuals a feeling for myth and symbol, ever so gently to transform Christ back into the soothsaying God of the vine, which he was and in this way absorb those ecstatic, instinctual forces of Christianity for the one purpose of making the cult and the sacred myth what they once were, a drunken feast of joy where man regained the ethos and holiness of an animal, end quote. And for Freud, that must have sounded like chalk on a blackboard.
Oh my God! I was wondering.
Jay, the gods are angry.
Could somebody translate the symbol of flies for me? You analysts out there, please.
I'm not wrong about those ecstatic
creatures.
Was it just a fly?
I think it was.
I really think it was a fly. It was
sometimes a fly is just a fly.
Does he have a family? Does he have a family?
There's no law of the father, not even in Christianity.
Let's see if it... I think it was, because there was a fly.
It was a fly.
It's a burnt offering.
Yeah,
I thought, oh my God, I'll finish this in the street, this talk. Don't go away. Please, don't go away. It's by the bus, right? Don't go away.
If it starts to happen again, we'll leap up and smell. Yes, the smell is...
Let's turn that off. Can we raise the lights? I guess.
It's burning.
A burnt offering. Oh, I have plenty of light from the screens. I do. I'm fine.
Let me know it's a fly. We're just assuming.
A fly?
Well, that's what was offered.
I see. The flies are sacrificed.
Yeah. First humans, then animals, then flies.
So.
So since their split, Carl Jung's reputation has generally been that of a popular but never fashionable thinker. He is usually dismissed as, at best, a middle-brow intellectual. For example, in Woody Allen's film Manhattan, he's included in a list of overrated people. But he has appealed to people looking for guidance in living, as well as creative individuals inspired by his insights into the nature of the human psyche. Jung's status in accounts of 20th century cultural history is due mostly to his marginalized place in the histories of psychoanalysis, where he is generally portrayed as a mystical anti-Semitic defector from the movement. I became intrigued to find out whether this member of Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club top row between Gothic Edgar Allan Poe and misanthropic W.C. Fields was really one of the secret architects of the Holocaust that a vociferous post-war critic implied when condemning Jung for not intervening to save Freud's sisters from the death camps. Talk about a projection. What we have then is a split image of Jung. First, there is Jung the villain. Ruth Shepherd's recent biography of Freud is the reason I'm here tonight. It recycles the half-truths of a party line that started with Freud, who labeled Jung an anti-Semite in his history of the psychoanalytic movement. Although this has become treated as gospel truth ever since, the truth is that it was Freud, not Jung, who more often played the race card during the years of their collaboration. Freud's ethnic sensibilities are most evident in his letters to Carl Abraham, where he made multiple references to their quote-unquote racial kinship, as Jews. On the other hand, we have Jung the hero. Until recently, most accounts of Jung's life, like Wounded Healer of the Soul and The Tao of Jung, have had a pious tone that take what I call a Stations of the Cross approach by genuflecting at each milestone of his life as recounted in memories, dreams, reflections. What we have then are competing narratives that generally talk past, but not to each other. Reconciling these contradictory images of the man led me to the conclusion that Jung's life can best be understood as that of a 20th century avant-garde conservative intellectual. He was a member of a European generation whose cultural sensibilities were shaped by the neo-romantic movement popular during their university years. In art and literature, they rejected naturalism, favoring symbolism and Art Nouveau. In politics, they deplored bourgeois parliamentary democracy, but also rejected socialism, preferring a Nietzschean elitism that was usually vague in its details. Put in this context, Jung can be seen as a member of what Isaiah Berlin called the Counter-Enlightenment, an intellectual movement that upheld the aristocratic principle in an age of mass democracy. Jung's conservative sympathies became more pronounced during the years of the First World War. It was then that an anti-Semitic white Russian emigre named Emil Mettner became his patient and friend. Jung was also acquainted with Dr. Eugen Berger, who was a fellow officer in the Swiss Medical Corps, serving with the Red Cross with the German Army, and who founded the Swiss Patriotic Association when fears of Bolshevik revolution were heightened during the Swiss general strike of 1918. And just to talk about the poster here, this is in fact not a Swiss poster, but a German poster of the same period. The title reads, "Do You Want This?" And below in capital letters, "Protect Your Land." And I'll just let you sort of absorb the imagery. The pastoral agricultural Germany, which was under threat by war, by defeat, by factories, by high-class financiers, of course, Jewish, stab-in-the-back crowd. And so this would have been popular throughout Germany during that period. And to suggest similar sentiment would have been found in Germany, in Switzerland, of course, a neutral country. But one must remember that Switzerland was not immune to the currents of European history. And there was a general strike that was quickly suppressed by the Swiss Citizens' Army in those years of turmoil around 1918. So this would have been the background sentiment that Eugen Berger and other related groups would have promoted, certainly not proto-fascist, although many later became that, but certainly in the period, it was patriotic. Defend the homeland from threat. And I would suggest that some of this sentiment was reflected in the epilogue of Jung's famous book, Psychological Types, where he wrote, quote, "In our age, which has seen the fruits of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity growing into a broad social movement whose aim is not merely to raise or lower political rights to the same general level, but more hopefully to abolish unhappiness altogether by means of external regulations and egalitarian reforms. In such an age, it is indeed a thankless task to speak of the complete inequality of the elements composing a nation. It was Jung's presidency of the General Medical Society for Psychotherapy that has caused the most controversy regarding his conduct during the Nazi era. The society was founded in 1926, and although boycotted by psychoanalytic societies, it did serve as an umbrella organization for a large and eclectic group of mostly German therapists. Jung became its president in 1933 and helped reorganize it as an international organization with constituent national groups and provisions in its bylaws meant to protect its Jewish members and avoid German domination. Most controversially, he made statements in its journal about the psychological differences between Aryans and Jews that have been widely quoted as the prima facie evidence that he was in fact anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi. Understanding exactly what Jung said during these years is not easy, since the translations done for the English collected works can be at variance with the German originals. I have time tonight to give only a couple of examples. The first is from an article he wrote in 1918 for a Swiss cultural journal. It's called The Role of the Unconscious and did not appear in English until its publication in 1964 as the lead paper in Volume 10 of Jung's collected works. It is critically important because it marked his first public discussion of the Aryan-Jewish divide and was the basis for the controversial remarks that he made later in the 1930s. At one point in the original German text, Jung addresses his readers as "Wir Germanen," we Germans. But the word Germans was deleted, and the passage was rewritten to make it seem that Jung was referring to we Europeans. What this means is that people are often quoting the translator Hull rather than Jung himself and constructing interpretations based on those misreadings. The most important example of this is from his 1936 article, Wotan, where Jung wrote about how Nazi Germany was on a dangerous course. But the phrase "dangerous course" appears in the collected works as "the road to perdition." It's a widely quoted phrase, but it's not what Jung wrote. The turn of phrase then implies an element of moral judgment that was not found in the original. Considering these and the other liberties that were taken, I feel that it is now time for Jung's collected works to be revised as his corrected works. Does all this then prove that he was, in fact, an anti-Semite pan-Nazi sympathizer? No. In spite of the racialized language they sometimes employed, a more nuanced portrait is necessary if we want to get closer to the truth. It was not Freud's Jewishness per se that bothered Jung, but rather the fact that he represented the modern Jewish intellectual whose one-sided scientific view of religion dismissed it as a superstitious relic of an unenlightened era. Jung disagreed with this assessment and felt that it only deepened people's alienation from a symbolic understanding of themselves and the world around them. If he was to be Freud's Joshua, then he wanted to follow the Moses of the burning bush, not the Moses of Mount Sinai. We must remember that Jung never subscribed to the biological racism of the Nazis, nor was he affiliated with Nazi psychiatry, as so often slips into the literature. It's a gross mistake. What he did do was to incorporate the German romantic concept of the Volksseele, the folk soul, into his thinking, an influence that's most obvious in the Votan article. This was a carryover from his university years and something not exclusive to Jung, but was a concept popular with other young intellectuals of his generation, like many of the first scientists. It has always been pointed out that some of Jung's most vocal defenders on the issue of his alleged anti-Semitism were Jews. It's not surprising then to learn that they had gone through a Zionist phase in their youth. To quote two of them from articles they wrote in his defense in 1934 when the controversy was heating up, the first of the two quotes. Quote, "There is still a bigger task before us, to rediscover in the soul also the living connection with the elementary forces. In this respect, the great psychologist Jung, who until now has been especially from the Jews treated with hostility and ignored in silence, can become a superb helper." The second quote. "We believe that Jungian psychology will become decisive for the attempt of the Jews to come to their fundamentals, especially the, so to speak, Zionistic character of his findings will be path-breaking." So let me sort of a transitional image for us. Of course, sorry, some of the details in the lower plane are not better represented. Many of you may be familiar, of course, with Jung's Red Book of recent years and great interest. To me, this is one of the most significant of the many images in the book. I believe, from what I've read, and most commentators tend to focus on the upper plane. Of course, the brilliant mandala, the spiritual transcendent zone, the yogi in the center, sort of as the mediator between the upper spiritual transcendental realm. But also, he is hovering over the lower plane, the mundane plane. And And this lower image is rather unusual in Jung's Red Bull's pictures and elsewhere, because it's essentially a folk art representation of Switzerland. But I would like to do a further dichotomization and focus. So, if you will, just create a dichotomy from the yogi to the bottom of the picture and let your eyes focus first on the left side and then on the right side. The left side is the world of sailboats, of farms, or forest, the land, the pastoral world of one side of Switzerland. But on the other side is the industrial Switzerland, of which she was also very aware. As a boy walking to school in Basel, he passed the chemical factories that were starting to be built along the Rhine River. So this would have been the world. He knew both worlds. This was his boyhood world, and then, of course, also boyhood, but I think a side of Switzerland that became challenging, troubling to him is the industrial, modern Switzerland. Sailboat on the left, steamboat on the right. Farm, factory. Below, you do see, it's a little harder for you to see, it is a Swiss Army scene. Here, it's a rifle range, which all Swiss men still participate actively in rifle range and citizen participation. But over here, you see a bunker, because during the First World War, the entire army was on duty for all 4 years. So here they are. So this was the world he knew, the real everyday world. But to me, a very significant element throughout Jung's Red Book is not just the direct symbolism, art. There's always, I would suggest, another element that we're invited to puzzle out. And by that, I'm pointing out the railroad smoke, factory smoke, steamboat smoke. Now consider the force of the wind that would be necessary to create horizontal smoke. It would have been gale force wind. So I think somewhere in the background of this imagery, I would suggest that Jung imagines the wind, Neuma spirit, blowing from the left, the pastoral world, perhaps the unconscious world, and sort of saving this pastoral world from the smoke and grit of modernity. Up to this point, I have focused on Jung's conservative side, but would now like to take a look at his avant-garde side. As Jung's divergence from Freud reached its point of no return, New York became a place where he began to fashion a new post-Freudian identity. His lectures at Fordham University and a lengthy interview with the Sunday New York Times in September 1912 had made him a local celebrity. He returned in March and was chaperoned around town by Beatrice Hinkle. Many of you may be familiar with this photograph. It is the conference the Weimar Congress photograph of attendees in 1911. Of course, a whole conference could be held on this particular meeting and all these founders of psychoanalysis. But just to pick out just a few for tonight. Freud, Jung, and of course in the front row you have the women attendees. And the one I will spend time with is Beatrice Hinkle. There she is, and I would suggest notice her place of honor. Freud, Jung, and Beatrice Hinkle. Who was she? She was a graduate of what became Stanford Medical School in 1899 and became a San Francisco public health doctor, being the first woman in the U.S. to hold that position. She relocated to New York, where she helped Charles Dana, America's leading neurologist, open a psychotherapy clinic at Cornell Medical School. As I mentioned, one of the first Americans to take an interest in psychoanalysis, she went to Europe, where she attended the Congress. She was a house guest of the Jungs and accompanied them and Freud on the train ride there to Weimar. She later published her translation of Jung's Wandlungen und Symbole der Libido as Psychology of the Unconscious. It became a bestseller and was closely read by such talents as Jack London, Eugene O'Neill, and Alfred Stieglitz. The book even was reviewed by the occultist Aleister Crowley for Vanity Fair when he was in the States for a year or two. So it certainly resonated. She was to be blackballed by A.A. Brill and the New York Psychoanalytic Society for her decision to align herself with Jung. Hinkle arranged for Jung to speak about dreams to the Liberal Club. It was New York's leading reform club, and among its members were the muckraking journalist Lincoln Steffens and the founders of the NAACP and the American Civil Liberties Union. The club also included many young Greenwich Village radicals, who, among other activities, were founding members of the Heterodoxy Club, America's first feminist group. Jung's attendance at one of their dinner parties was remembered this way. Quote, guests ranged from university professors and writers to distinguished labor administrators. They still talked about a visit by the famous analyst Carl G. Jung. The atmosphere had been rather stiff and formal until Jung broke the ice by addressing a pet dog who was misbehaving with his leg. Come, be reasonable. I'm not a female. He knew colloquial English very, very well. His busy social schedule included a visit with the Bohemian artist-poet Khalil Gibran, who did his pencil portrait. So this was a pencil portrait. Gibran's studio was about a block from where the party was. I have not been able to quite get the sequence yet, but I'm still tracking down. But it's likely Jung would have visited his studio, had his pencil portrait done, and later became a part of a book called Temple of Art. It has about 20 portraits, Isidore Duncan, and many of the leading cultural figures of the time. I guess Chevron would sort of push in the stage door, say, "May I do your portrait?" And they accommodate him. It seems certain that Jung attended the 1913 Armory Show in New York. This was the art show recently, of course, celebrated, that created a sensation by introducing the American public to such pioneering modern artists as Matisse, Picasso, and Kandinsky. Jung, whose artistic background was in German Romanticism and Symbolism, got a crash course in modern art, just like everybody else who attended. Of course, the most notorious picture at the show was Marcel Duchamp's nude descending a staircase. But what many people don't know, that the most prominently featured and best-selling artist was the French symbolist Odilon Redon. And although this is what we associate with the show, this was there, the early Matisse's, a Picasso bust, and this is what we think of as the art of the time that was, what was most appealing and best-selling to the people and art buyers was work by Redon. I just picked up one of many. It's Venus on a proverbial half-shell, mythological, and what happened was I just had recently discovered that Jung, on display and for sale at the show, was Redon's complete graphic works. And I located in Jung's book catalog that he did buy that edition and would suggest that he might have purchased it maybe after returning to Zurich. So, it's a suggestion, proof to follow, but certainly a visit, an impact of Redon, and his own interest in Redon's work. And this is important because that fall, he began his series of what we know as Acton Imaginations. These were dialogues with unconscious fantasy figures that he recorded in his Red Book. It's medieval format reflects the devotion to traditional handicrafts that was characteristic of William Morris and the arts and crafts movement. The pictures he did for the first book, Liber Primus, mostly illustrate these active imaginations in a rather straightforward, illustrative way. But what one sees in Liber Secundus is that the pictures that he did begin to take on a life of their own. He began to experiment with artistic elements from Byzantine, Islamic, Celtic, and tribal art. And all of this collectively reflects the popularity of what's now known as the Orientalist theme in the arts of the time. Just to illustrate this, this is not from the Red Book. This is a fantasy figure, Telesphoros. A version of this is in the Red Book. And I would suggest that was the draft of what he later did as an independent picture, this one. So it is in the Red Book, but pretty washed out, but it was formally this image, I would suggest that he was so taken by Telesphoros in this image that he did it a second time. And first of all, the marine mosaics, and what I think is very interesting is his increasing command of art technique. You see the nimbus, very light here, around the figure, the haloed nimbus of a sacred figure, and of course, the outer marine imagery, mosaic-like. And did this come just straight out of his unconscious? I suggest not. What was popular at the time? The ballet russe. It was everywhere. Of course, one of the many costumes by Leon Basques for the, this was from Scheherazade, and certainly inviting you. The pantaloons, the arabesque, of course. And what I've noticed part of this, my suspicion is, why did he like this? Because in spite of his art talent, he did not have a command of the human figure. So what better thing to do than to wrap it up in billowing? Also, sandals. So just a suggestion that, of course, to be discussed perhaps later, where what's the source of his images? Certainly his unconscious. But what was there filtering his artistic expression would have been so much the art of the time. Well, where does all this leave us? Let me close by saying politically, Jung was a man of distinct conservative sympathies. If he had been British, he would have been a Tory. If an American, he would have been a Republican. Culturally, on the other hand, he was always something of a maverick, promoting a sensibility that valued the symbolic experience. And this interest extended to such collective trends as gender, creative intuition, and alternative spiritual traditions. For example, Jung was one of the first psychologists to interpret the post-war UFO craze as an emergent myth reflecting the anxieties of our nuclear age. So in conclusion, to have a more rounded and accurate portrait of Jung, we need to consider both his conservative and his avant-garde sides. Since taken together, they formed the double helix of his cultural DNA. Thank you. So maybe we'll just take a minute. Carol can maybe be the director of...
I was just going to get a chair.
For Gary.
Thank you. I mean, I think there's an enormous amount of food for thought, which I think Gary was going to come up and lead the discussion.
No, I think it was.
I'll just give you this one to ponder. So, Gary, let's get this out of the way.
Near this?
That's okay. Please, Gary.
Right. Well, thank you, Jane, for a fascinating talk. Thank you, Carol, for asking me to come and say a few words. I mean, there's a lot there. You pulled quite a few punches in your talk compared to the sort of direction that you take in the book. I was going to say, if you don't know the book, and if you don't like Jung, all of your worst fears are confirmed. if you do like Jung, all of your worst fears are confirmed in it. No, it's a lot of interesting connections between my own book on Jung, which is called Jung the Mystic, which deals with Jung's relationship, ambivalent relationship to the occult, which Jay didn't touch on, but which is broadly connected to, in a very wide sense, sort of Jung's political context and his interest in myth and the irrational, things of that sort, which tend to get blended in with criticisms of his political stance. There's a broad polarity between sort of the modern, scientific, rational approach to these things and a kind of foot-dragging, conservative, mythic, traditional sort of reaction to modernity. And I would say a lot that Jay discusses in his book about Jung and about the cultural context in which Jung was working and the people that he knew and the people that took advantage of his work was in this, under this kind of umbrella of the sort of response to modernity, response to the threat of modernity in many ways. In the picture from Jung's Red Book that, that Jay sort of analyzed for us here, when he showed the sort of the bottom bit, not the mystical bit up top, but the bottom bit with this sort of peasant, sort of Henri Rousseau kind of picture of Switzerland, where you have. Now I was wondering. Now
should we go back to it?
Well, we can go back to it. But I was thinking, in one sense, it should be the other way around, because look, from the pictures, from the audience's perspective, all that modern stuff should be on the left, actually, rather than on the right. So in this sense, maybe there's a coded message in there because he's mixing it up as well. But there is this kind of general notion of the threat of modernity, that modernity is going to uproot all of these traditional values that people had, both in a political, social, familial kind of sense, but in a broader religious kind of sense. But why I'm bringing this up is that in my own book, I said that Jung did sort of sit on the fence about his relationship to the occult and to the paranormal, in which he had a private relationship with it, which was part of his life from the beginning. His mother was psychic and all this kind of stuff, and went on throughout his whole life. But then he had a public image where he kept saying that he was a scientist, and he wasn't a mystic, and he wasn't an occultist, and he wasn't a philosopher and all this kind of thing. And that was an interesting kind of context to look at what you were doing in your book, because in our exchange, an email exchange we had, you said you thought it'd be interesting to talk about these different pictures of Jung, these different kinds of things. And I think you could say Jung is someone who emphasized what he wasn't quite a bit. He sort of had a checklist of things that, depending on who was interviewing him, he would say he wasn't that at the time. And I have to say, I'm not a Jungian. I'm not here to defend Jung. I give Jung the benefit of the doubt. I tend to like Jung more than Freud. Sorry. No, I thought, sorry. I was looking if someone was going to throw something at me. But I was over there. And the progressive side of Jung, I would say, personally, I think it has less to do with his interest in avant-garde modernism, in that he had a kind of forward-looking view of the psyche, whereas I think Freud didn't have that quite as much. I think Freud kind of looked at a kind of stasis. There was a sort of normality you were supposed to arrive at, and you were well-adjusted, and you fit into society. And Jung had a picture where it went sort of beyond that. It's sort of beyond health or something like that. That then enters dangerous territories. But what I was going to say is maybe we should start with this whole idea of, like, these different pictures of Jung. These different. You're talking about Jung the avant-garde conservative. I'm talking about Jung the mystic. What you've shown us here is Jung certainly was an artist, even though he took great pains to tell everyone who would listen to him that he wasn't an artist. And this was something that he, that almost as much as he says he's not a mystic, he says he isn't an artist. And where I would say, technically, I wouldn't call Jung a mystic, because he's actually trying to make sense of these visions. He's not just saying he has them and giving them to you wholesale. He's actually trying to analyze them, interpret them, give them some kind of intellectual context, which most mystics don't do. They just basically tell you they've had this vision, and the vision itself is its own justification. Jung's trying to understand it. But I would say he certainly was an artist. And do you think, why do you think Jung went out of his way to sort of make sure or try to say to so many people that he wasn't an artist?
I think he was concerned that he would be interpreted just to be seen aesthetically and not psychologically. And this gets into the whole issue of saying I'm an artist, or are we doing art? The whole idea of labeling oneself, I think, is significant. He wasn't. He was a psychiatrist, he was a psychoanalyst. We know, of course, all those professional identities. But he was hesitant about how that could compromise the professional credentials. One of his colleagues, Ricklin, around the same time Jung was doing the Red Book, an associate did become affiliated with some of the early Dadaists in Zurich, and Jung thought he was lost to psychology. He dabbled, he went to Café Voltaire, and it was all over. So he was very ambivalent about Dadaism. He had very scathing things to say because he saw them as nihilists.
Well, I think it has something to do also that he wanted to be saying he's discovering this. He's not I'm not making these things. If it's only art, then it's my will, my creative drive. I'm doing these paintings because of aesthetic reasons or self-expression. And I think he's saying, this isn't self-expression, this is self-exploration. These are things I'm finding in the psyche when I go there. But I think it's very interesting when you show that, not this one, but the other one, where you have the character in the kind of Persian pajamas and the whole thing. It's obvious that he's learned a great deal of technique. And two things struck me. The character seems to have a Louise Brooks haircut, which might have been, not this one, but the other one. Yeah, she's kind of got a Louise Brooks haircut. And if you don't know, Louise Brooks was an actress who was very famous at the time in silent films and all that. But all this also looks like Klimt. I mean, I don't know exactly. It's around the same time, which puts him back in Vienna with Freud and all that. But it's interesting, just let me get a little bit of water here. It's also the whole... I can see the conservative in Jung, but just going by, sort of the remarks he makes about contemporary art at the time, modern art at the time, I didn't see so much a connection with the avant-garde. And I'll just read a little bit from a letter. I'm sure you know this. I have to say, I was quite stunned by the amount of research that Jay did. A letter in 1940, he wrote that I loathe the new style, the new art, the new music, literature, politics, and above all, the new man. And in another letter, shortly after, he asked, why in hell is man unable to grow up? Now, I think, we should point out that Jung wasn't the only one saying these kinds of things at the time. I mean, it was kind of de rigueur for many at the time to complain about what they saw as the baleful effects of modernity in different contexts and all that. And we also know that Jung, wasn't it the case that he was asked to write an article about Picasso for some magazine, and he wrote some scathing thing that they actually didn't want to publish or something along
those lines? It was published in Zurich, and it created a scandal.
And then likewise about James Joyce's Ulysses, which I think he called a tapeworm. So, I mean, again, where you're finding these connections with Jung, with the avant-garde, in a very ostensible, extroverted way. He's making remarks that place him in the exact opposite camp. So there's a great deal of this kind of... I guess it might make sense, because later on he's talking about the coincidenta oppositorum and the bringing together the opposites. So perhaps this kind of waffling, which an ungenerous view might see it as, is an expression of this kind of bringing together of the opposites.
Well, you spoke here, thank you. What I would want to do is uncouple avant-garde with modernism.
Oh, okay.
we associate modernism with the figures you mentioned, but Jung's taste, to me, was this pre-war avant-garde. The war was such, of course, a split culturally, politically, economically. And Jung started the Red Book prior to the war. I think his taste and milieu, which, in fact, the Red Book, we would say it's not modernist, it's symbolic or whatever,
yes.
But it's quite characteristic of the immediate, of the Klimt,
yes.
Of the Ballet Russe, that his work is not outside that. His taste, which evolved through the 20s and 30s, was of that earlier pre-war avant-garde period. What got his goat, so to speak, was where it went. Because the post-war generation rejected much of this as romantic nonsense.
Yes.
But that was his affiliation. And I would suggest, I'll go out on a limb, have to, is so much of our own taste is shaped in those earlier, in our 20s, 30s, for me, you know, university years, maybe for many of us, music, art, preferences.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think you're absolutely right, because much of the pre-war avant-garde, which would have included here people like Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells, were considered old hat after the war. People like Huxley is writing novels that kind of satires of Wells's Utopia. Another artist who shared, who's avant-garde, but also shared with Jung conservative points of view, but had no interest in myth and tradition, was the writer and artist Wyndham Lewis, who also took people like Shaw and much of the pre-World War I avant-garde to task afterwards. So I bring up Lewis just to show that you don't have to have an interest in myth and the irrational to be interested in a more conservative kind of what we would call right-wing sort of politics. Lewis's beef was that he wanted a stable society so that he could go and pursue his art and not have to worry about all the kind of turmoil that was happening in post-war Europe. So, like Jung, Lewis thought, when he was first becoming aware of things happening in Germany and Hitler coming to power and in the early days, he thought something good might come out of it. Now, he wasn't alone in doing that. Many other people thought that at the time, too. Lewis wrote a book, actually, more or less a quick book of journalism, basically saying, this is what's going on in Germany. Actually, it looks kind of good. You know, there's highways being built, the buses run on time, and so on, that kind of thing. And then later he realized it was a mistake, and he wrote a book saying why he was wrong and all that. Martin Heidegger, who's a contemporary of both Wyndham Lewis and Jung, if you're familiar with this at all, he famously joined the party. I think he stayed for about a year or something. I think he dropped out fairly soon after. But there's a famous, scandalous, infamous is more like it, sort of lecture he gave, sort of praising the rise of National Socialism as this was Germany finding its destiny and coming to an understanding of its true being and so on and so on. I just say this to say, it's easy for us in hindsight to look back and say, God, what were these guys thinking? You know, didn't they know? We don't know how we would react in that context. And also that the kinds of responses that were happening to modernity at the time, I think were valid. One of the things I was saying to Jay the other day, yesterday when we met briefly, was that I think it's important to understand that there is a problem of modernity, that these aren't just basically conservative types who want to kind of hold on to whatever privilege they have because they don't want society to be sort of changed and that they're no longer in some privileged state. I think there are some real psychological, sociological, ontological problems inherent in modernity. But I think we also need to save the valid responses to the question of modernity from some of the more extreme exponents of them. People sort of, let's say, to the right of Jung, let's say, that you talk about quite a bit in the book. And I think it's, you certainly place Jung in that context. He's certainly in the context of all these people at the time reacting to the rise of modernity. You talk about the conservative revolution going on in Germany at the time. And it just, like I said, it strikes me, it's very difficult for us now to put ourselves back in that position without carrying all the baggage that we have now about hindsight and the very touchy reaction we have to questions about anti-Semitism or notions that questioning egalitarianism and all that. And I'm just wondering, throughout the book, you say in your talk here that you said, no, Jung, you know, he wasn't a Nazi, more or less, and no, he wasn't anti-Semitic. But was it difficult for you to come to that no? Did you have to work to get to that no, or was that no there? And, you know,
throughout.
Yeah.
You know, one has to let historical evidence speak. It's what speaks. I'm just the channel and the interpreter.
You're just following orders.
All this material, much of which is very compromising, and it's the stuff that often stays in the closet.
Yes, yes.
Is it what should be in the front window? No. But, you know, it's the closet as well as, if you will, what's in the front window.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
It's part of that whole picture.
Yes.
And you're quite right about hindsight, of course. Mm. Always the dilemma of hindsight. Because you say Jung, Hitler, Nazis, and then, of course, what comes to mind is the Holocaust.
Yeah.
We know. It's inevitable. It's powerful. It's immediate. But when we go back to 33, 34, 35, it's those nuances, those slow predations in individuals and incentive reactions to Hitler and the Nazis. You know, where did one stand in 33 or 34? He did shift by the time of the war, by 37. Of course, in the book, he was resolutely aware that Germany was bad, dangerous, and he then sort of realigned with his Anglo-American circle a bit.
Yes.
So, certainly, many people, of course, in the secondary literature, you know, he recanted, if you will, after the war. Not at all. Mm. You know, like so many, it's not in the book, but there was a quote somewhere, Lloyd George said, Hitler's the George Washington of Germany. And that's Lloyd George speaking of Hitler. Mm-hmm. So, you know, challenging characterizations. But, so just, you know, what was said and done, 33, of course, by the time of the war, he knew it was an evil agenda. Mm. He dropped affiliations, withdrew from the presidency. But what always comes up, and this is so critical to the man, he's Swiss. And just all the many nuances of a Swiss identity.
Well, we're saying how it's landlocked, it's surrounded by other countries, so it's almost unavoidable to sit on a fence, right? Because there's a lot of fences around you, so.
And they are consummate diplomats.
Yes.
And Jung was too.
Well, I think Jung also was very tactical. I think he also had an eye for. How should I say? He wasn't a careerist, but I would say he sort of knew when it was time to talk and when it was time to not. And perhaps that's a clue for me. And maybe we should open this up to some people out in the audience who might have some questions. To address the J, please don't ask me anything. This gentleman back there.
I have difficulty with the linking of conservatism to present day conservatism, i.e. Republican and the British conservatives. Yeah. And therefore, I can see he has conservative, he associates himself with conservative values from the point of view of art. But I can't see that you can actually boldly, as you very boldly stated, that he's linked to the Republicans and conservatives now, because they've changed so much since through contemporary issues. And I just think it's not helpful to link that. But more importantly, going back, young in the 60s, when I was young, had a resurgence due to the whole hippie influence, the transcendental meditation, seeking for a form of knowledge that wasn't, or a form of knowledge and religion and myth that wasn't part of the war and sort of back to some thing back to spiritualism, which also links in, I would have thought, with the art of, say, Bats or Verdon or whatever, that grew quite gradually, as you said, from the Morris and around then and Yeats and the whole sort of artistic milieu where they were searching for influences and interests. And so therefore, I see the conservative aspect, but just leave it as a conservative aspect, I would have thought. It brings up too many other difficult notions to link in with the present day conservative.
Well, when I said Republic, of course, I was imagining a contemporary characterization, but in fact, in the 30s, he loathed FDR and the New Deal, so he was, you know, a man of the right even then. With that context, he spoke at Harvard in 36 at the Tricentennial Conference. He gave an interview in New York saying, FDR is a great leader. He speaks to one of the local papers here in London. FDR has a power complex. He's the stuff of a dictator, which is what all the Republicans were saying in America in 1936.
You can't associate that. I think of him more as a libertarian.
Okay, you know, that would take us
he
back.
He is kind of a individual who associate himself with politics. I mean, he's very dramatic because he even wanted to be a child of Goethe. So you know, he has this very Germanness in him, although he's Swiss.
Yes, you know, German cultural.
German-Swiss.
I was just saying, it's interesting, though, you bring up the 60s, because obviously Jung, as Jay said, he's on the cover of, you know, Sgt. Pepper's. But he was talking about the Age of Aquarius in 1940, much, much earlier than it had been popularized. It was sort of something that in occult milieus was being discussed, but it wasn't something that was... you know, kind of a common phrase as it became by the late 60s and all that, but Jung was one of the earliest ones to talk about that. But as far as I know, he didn't have the hippies by the time he was alive, but he did have the Beats, and he didn't think much of them, and he didn't like what he heard about the LSD experiments and all that sort of thing. And another hero of the 60s who was still around when the hippies were was Tolkien. And you mentioned, you know, you wanted, I don't know if we'll get to it, but you mentioned a kind of connection between Jung and Tolkien. And Tolkien famously hated the long hairs who came and knocked on his door in Oxford. So these things get recycled. They get, I'm not anti-pro anything. I'm just saying these things kind of get recycled. But a lot of the stuff that became, the reason I'm talking about this is because I've written a book about the 60s and the whole revival of occult ideas in it. And a lot of it was precisely what you're saying. It's stuff that was around at the time that Jung... this turn of the century, early 20th century, a lot of these ideas, vegetarianism, philosophy, life reform and all this thing became very, very popular then, and that was rediscovered at that time as well. So it's in, these kind of ideas kind of come back in different cycles, this lady here.
Anne Case, and I wish other people would say who they are. So I just read the book on the... a celebration of the centenary of the Fordham Letters, which you have a chapter, a very good chapter.
It's out. One. I haven't seen it.
What?
You've seen it?
Well, Nancy Cato asked me to do the blurb on the back of the book.
Oh, nice.
So
I'm looking forward to it.
I read it online. There's so many things I could take up in what you've told us this evening. And the two main points you're discussing between yourselves are the art, which one to say huge amounts of art. And I gave a paper in Berlin at Wolfgang D. Richards for the first conference dedicated to his work, looking at why the word sublime does not appear in the general index. Which is very telling. And I gave all kinds of reasons why I thought that was lacking in Jung. I think basically he's terrified of being seduced by his artistic side. as he thought of Richmond was. The other thing I wanted to take up was this never-ending accusation of him as being Nazi and anti-Semitic. There is, I don't know if you know this, Jay, but there's a file that the British Foreign Office has on Jung.
I've heard of it, I've never seen it, so I
got
to know
about it many years ago. And it houses an attempt to bring Jung to trial at Nuremberg, supported by a New Yorker, the accusation, that he's a Nazi auxiliary. And the British Foreign Office looked at this very closely because, as you know, Nuremberg was going on from 45 to 46. And Lord Vansittart, who was a well-known British diplomat at the time, was encouraging this man called Maurice Leon to bring this charge against Jung. But what the conclusion of the British Foreign Office in the end was that the best thing to do with it was to throw it in the trash can. They said it was a lot of rubbish.
Yes.
The text of the accusation reads terribly like some of Noel's writing. He tried to get a little far from me, which I didn't recommend. But it's awfully like what's being said in the file. It's kind of laughable. A lot of what this Leon man is. I'm not for a moment suggesting that Jung wasn't culpable in some ways for bringing about these accusations. I do wonder, actually, you mentioned Heidegger, whether the best way forward for him would have been not to try and explain anything.
Well, he didn't. Heidegger never said a word.
So 67.
That's exactly
right. Well, with the Spiegel, yeah.
The more that Jungians try to whitewash, it does no good at all.
I personally don't think Jung was a Nazi. This sounds silly saying it, but I don't think he was. I give him the benefit of the doubt. I think he skated dangerously close in many ways. I think he was more concerned with showing people he was right about these differences in the psyche than whether, this is going to get me in trouble for saying this. So I think he had a bit... But at the same time, he was saying similar things later on. He was saying similar things later on in the 40s and when he was warning Westerners not to take up Eastern methods of meditation, even though he wrote many introductions, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Secret of the Golden Flower, the I Ching. He always said that we Westerners, this is why he was so interested in alchemy, as far as I know, this we have our own spiritual tradition. Our psyche is like this. It's not like the Eastern one. We can learn from these things. Let's learn about them, study them, but we shouldn't chuck all of our Western, ways aside and go embrace all these Eastern kind of things. So that doesn't necessarily exonerate him from injudicious statements he said, at a time. But it was an idea that didn't just pop up at that time for him. It wasn't like, oh yes, this is a handy thing for me to say now to advance my career in German speaking countries. It's actually, this is a concern that he had later on in life as well. There are different kinds of psyches in that certain sense. And again, this is a reaction, I would say, or a response, rather than reaction, a response to the kind of universalism that is associated with modernity, the kind of blank slate, the tabula rasa view. We all have empty heads until we go to IKEA, buy a bunch of stuff and, put it inside. Jung was saying, no, actually, we come with furnished apartments, basically. We've got a certain kind of basic kind of stuff there. And that's very anti-modern, I would guess. So,
and that, to me, brings us back to the Fox sailor. Mm-hmm. It seems out of date, but it was an operative format that Jung operated within. Of course, he went in many directions. But it was there. It was part of his milieu, his readings, exposure. Yeah. It was just there in his, the stuff of his intellectual...
It's the Germanic...
Yeah. The Germanic parents.
I would say also the kind of leveling that Jung perceived as part of the modern narrative of democracy and all that. People like William Blake, who's a national poet here. I mean, one law for lion and ox is oppression. I mean, we the British should celebrate Blake, you know, it did those feat in ancient times, but he definitely was not democratic in that sense. I mean, and again, these are fiery words, if you like the, you know, the paper, and they can explode, but these are kinds of things that we need to sort of look at in a broader context, I would say, yeah.
And maybe, just adjacent to this thought, returning to his, I think, still very formative, critical Swiss identity was, in our own projections on these men, we wish he'd been a moral hero. And he wasn't. You know, why didn't he speak out? Why didn't he save 38? Because after the war, he had an incredibly sophisticated analysis of Hitler's a psychopath. Why didn't you say that in 38? I mean, that's a rhetorical question.
Sure.
You know, brilliant insight. Gee, it would have been so much better if it was published in 38.
Kind of shutting the barn after the horses
just a little
escaped,
bit.
Right.
And certainly insightful, legitimate.
This gentleman over here?
Will you finish? I'm
sorry.
Good guy. Yeah, on that last point, I think people like Marcuse or Eric Fromm and William Wright were also writing about fascism in that style. I don't know if Jung influenced by that or read comments on that. What did he say about Freud's exodus from Vienna? Did he have any commentary on that?
Well, there's the famous story that Anne might know. I've read it. I'm not a...
I've been told it personally, actually.
Yeah, and so, Anne, I would refer to you, please. There was a famous story of his son, Franz, going with a money belt. May I invite you to share it?
I told this by the address, because I worked very closely with the address. And what apparently happened was that the young centricum to meet
they just like they can't hear you.
This is a very precious story. Anne, would you mind standing? Please, if you don't mind.
Yes, excuse me. I've got the tiniest horse in the world. I can project practically everything else, but what I was told, this is by Gerhard Adler, who was one of the editors of the collective works of the English language collective works of Jung, was that Jung sent Richlin this money to Vienna after the Anschluss, because, as you know, Anna Freud had already been taken in by the SS and positioned, and there was great fear that something would happen to Anna Freud and to Sigmund Freud. And so he sent with money to Vienna to help to get Freud to Zurich. And Freud's famous answer was, "I never take money from my enemies."
Yes.
You have the same question. This is what I got from Gerhard Adler. Can I just take up one other point which you said earlier in your story, which I was very interested in, was again from both Gerhard Adler and from Michael Fordham, was on Hull, who I think is a very significant figure, and I agree with you about the translations, right? As you probably know, there have been huge splits in the UK Jungian community, and we now have 5 group members of the International. I work very closely with the Jungian International. We have our headquarters in Zurich. And Fordham and Adler, the bad feeling between them, and there's a huge personality clash, I think, between those two men coming from such different backgrounds. They gave me very different versions of working with Hull. And so, frankly, everything I brought out would bring up with one, the other one would contradict. And you know Joyce's famous saying of Dr. Tweedledum in Vienna and Dr. Tweedledee in Zurich. Really, you know, were like Freud and Jung, but then repeated again within the Jungian movement between Fordham and Gerhard Adler, coming from different backgrounds, trying to found different Jungian traditions in the UK, and Fordham said that that Howe was very good to work with. He had no problem with him and with his translations, but of course he wasn't a native German speaker. Adler was brought in by him himself because he was a native German speaker. He came from Berlin, Adler. And he said that he had great difficulty with working with Howe. So I was interested in what you said. You know,
and there were many. The book, of course, elucidates them. There were dozens.
Yeah.
There were deletions.
Yeah.
Significant deletions.
Yeah.
One of many more critical deletions was in one of his 34 articles, one of the notorious articles, he deleted a description of psychoanalysis as pulverizing, which he did. There was a whole crossover with the Nazi linguistic field, there's no question. Is he a Nazi? No. But was there a linguistic field that was created in Germany? Yes, there was. And he was in and out of it. It was one thing to bash psychoanalysis on other terms, which one could debate. But how low do you go when you accuse it of being pulverizing, which was strictly an adoption of Nazi buzzwords?
I just mentioned two quick things, and I'll get the gentleman back there. I was going to say, do you think Jung was purposely doing that, or was he just caught up in it and just... Because, you know, he's a bad writer.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sorry to say that. I mean, Freud's a much better writer. Jung is just a bad writer. Someone
aggressive.
Was he just picking up whatever chat was in the air at the time? Do you think Hull was just trying to make his writing more readable? Or was he trying to whitewash it?
I would make the case that there's a degree of sanitization going on. Because of the post-war controversy, I'm proposing that there was, in part, somewhat of a deliberate effort to sanitize some critical places. The fact, how can a translator drop a keyword and then rewrite a passage? It's not acceptable. Translators can't rewrite. You can create a nuance. You don't drop Wir Germanen and suggest Jung's talking about we Europeans. You just don't do it. So, I think there was an effort. But going back to your... It was not deliberate. So much of it, all of us is... If I can say all of us, we participate in the linguistic field.
Yeah.
Here and there, mix and match. I use it once, I don't do it again. I like this. I stay with it for a while. It's a conceptual linguistic instrument. And that was part of it. And sadly, kind of maybe coming back in full circle... is still, and it's widely written about, is his unresolved emotional attachment to Freud. Both met. And I was going to say, and vice versa. As I was getting ready to come here, I read about 6 books on the shelf that have been there for 20 years about Freud. Gee, you better read them before you go to London. And one of the books I also reread by Freud was Moses and Monotheism. And I was really surprised when I saw my 30-year-old underlining in the book about 2 pages toward the end. He's addressing the collective unconscious. In the closing months of his life, Freud in this house still had to struggle with Jung. Damn it, I've got to still engage with Jung and his agenda.
That gentleman,
that was written in the closing months.
So that gentleman back there with glasses?
Yeah, thanks. That was a great talk. That would be such a good line to end on as well.
Yeah.
I feel bad about asking another question. Well, it's just a kind of comment really about the polarization that seems to come out for both of you, I suppose, about the conservative versus the modernism, or the pre-war avant-garde, the post-war avant-garde. And I felt it was a little bit like the... polarity in the mandala picture, the kind of timeless medieval world on one side and the industrial nihilistic world on the other. But I wanted to complicate that by thinking about the immediate post-war modernists, the big ones in England at least, so like Joyce writing about Ulysses, T.S. Eliot and the Grail legends, pound counters, and various mythologies, Indian mythology, that all those modernist writers, you know, as much as they're interested in the experimental and the new, are always at the same time reactively reaching as far back as possible to the timeless and the primitive. So that dyad of conservative avant-garde doesn't seem so anomalous for the time. It's very much in tune with the modernists themselves are doing. And it perhaps explains why someone as avant-garde as Jackson Pollock, a bit later in line, is still grappling with the primitive and might be drawn.
Well, he was a Jungian too, wasn't he?
Pollock was a Jungian too. So thank you, Matt. And so that would be, of course, the subject for another lecture about both men the primitive. So
let's have a hand for Jay.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I think I have to.